following is a previously broadcast program.
C. C is for...
Cauliflower.
Confusion. Creation.
Pickle. K is for...
Kitten.
Camp.
C, wait. Unroofly. U, unbearable.
U is for underground.
Oh, yeah.
Umbrella.
T. Trite.
Tremendous.
Torment.
Tire.
C, K.
I can't think of a U one. T.
T.
F is for famous.
Fun. Fumble. M is for Montreal.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Hi, my name is Sarah Jesmer, and you're listening to CKUT on 90.3 FM. For the next hour, from 5 to 6 p.m., we're going to be tuning into an episode of It's Going Down Radio. This is their March 2nd, 2022 episode. It's called An Anarchist Critique of the State of the Union, Organizing Against the Far-Right Convoy, and Ukraine for Dummies. It includes an interview with Montreal-based community member and longtime anarchist organizer Jaggi Singh. Again, we're going to be listening to this all the way up to the 6 p.m. hour. If you want to hear the rest of this episode, it's at itsgoingdown.org/thisisamerica160. This is CKUT. Stay tuned.
Welcome to This Is America, March 2nd, 2022. On today's episode, first we bring you an anarchist critique of Biden's State of the Union address. We then present an interview with long-term anarchist organizer in so-called Canada, Jaggi Singh, who speaks about the recent counter-demonstrations which took place against far-right convoy protests in Ottawa and beyond. While this interview is about a week old, it offers some clear insights for those in the so-called U.S. as another round of far-right convoy protests is being organized as we speak. A fair warning though, this interview contains a lot of cursing. We then switched our discussion where we discussed the Ukraine, how police in Florida attempted to brand someone arrested outside of a rally in support of far-right J6 defendants as a member of an Antifa sleeper cell, and much more. Let's dive right in. Biden presented his first State of the Union speech on Tuesday, attempting to project a sense of strength and national unity to a nation increasingly divided by inequality amidst the backdrop of escalating war in the Ukraine and a growing fascist threat at home. Speaking in front of a largely massless audience of military brass, politicians, and foreign dignitaries, Biden championed a growing economy, declared himself once again a capitalist, and attacked defunding the police. Moreover, Biden attempted to sell the idea, as has the rest of the neoliberal class, that the pandemic is winding down and defeated, when in reality, thanks to heavy corporate lobbying and changes in CDC rules, the ruling class has now transitioned into accepting the pandemic as an endemic and is now pushing workers to adjust to an unending cycle of infection and death. Marching lockstep, the CDC has, in the lead-up to Biden's speech, moved to classify formerly high-risk areas of infection to now low or medium risk in order to justify encouraging around 70% of the U.S. population to stop wearing masks. This move has also been coupled by a push to end mask wearing in public schools. As one report wrote, the recent changes by the CDC come weeks before the official death toll of the U.S. surpasses 1 million, with one site recording 973,119 deaths from COVID-19 in the U.S. and nearly 2,000 people dying each day. Like Trump, the Democrats are attempting to normalize death of frontline workers, the elderly, the poor, and those lacking access to health care. As rents have skyrocketed, inflation has soared, the climate crisis grows more dire, and capitalists have attempted to recoup lost profits during the last 2 years of the pandemic. But this collective push towards marketing mass death and disease as the new normal by both corporate parties is only matched by the growing social crisis. While Biden claimed in his speech that his administration was a departure from the trickle-down economics that revolved around giving tax breaks to the rich, under the pandemic, the wealth and racial wealth divide is the highest it's been since World War II, as Wall Street is reporting record profits. While Biden again paid lip service to things like raising the minimum wage to a paltry $15 an hour, his administration has failed to deliver on any of the bread and butter issues people voted him into office to pass, such as gutting student debt, making college tuition free, and raising wages. And as Biden painted a bright picture for the economy, he was doing so just as eviction moratoriums in many major cities are ending. While in the 50 largest U.S. metro areas, median rent rose an astounding 20% from December 2020 to December 2021. Meanwhile, growing houseless encampments are met with police brutality and eviction sweeps. And 2 years after the George Floyd uprising, police continue to kill on average around 3 people per day. According to the Washington Post, in 2021, police shot and killed at least 1,055 people nationwide last year, the highest total since the Washington Post began tracking fatal shootings by officers in 2015. The stark realities of the social and class war that defined the Trump era have only gotten worse and deepened under Biden, not gotten better. Despite running on a platform that attempted to pay lip service to Black Lives Matter and George Floyd, Biden and the Democrats have done nothing but repeatedly call for more funding of the police. This woke version of law and order was repeated by Biden during his State of the Union address, as he stated, "We should all agree the answer is not to defund the police, it's to fund the police. Fund them with resources and training. Resources and training they need to protect their communities." This sentiment echoes calls by neoliberals at the Washington Post and the New York Times, both of which have erroneously blamed the rise in gun violence and shooting deaths on the George Floyd rebellion, the defund the police movement and Black Lives Matter, and specifically on anarchists. In reality, while crime has been in overall decline since the 1990s, the current rise in gun violence is directly tied to the rise in poverty and lack of access to basic resources, which has been exacerbated during the pandemic. Studies have shown that there is no direct link between the current rise in gun violence and a change in cities' massive police budgets, many of which have fluctuated due to tax shortfalls due to COVID-19, not because of pressure from social movements, while crime itself isn't impacted by the number of police on the force to begin with. But the rise in gun-related violence and death speaks to a deepening social crisis that neither Democrats nor Republicans want to address. In both cities controlled by either party, gun violence rose during the pandemic as people grew more desperate. This deadly reality has been matched by an exploding suicide and overdose crisis, which has become a key touchstone to life under neoliberal capitalism. But in the face of this reality, Biden's solution is to double down on the role of the cops. In regards to fighting the opioid pandemic, he stated, "Stop the flow of illicit drugs by working with state and local law enforcement," and touted a plan to hire more teachers, seemingly oblivious to the fact that so many have quit due to the unsafe working conditions his administration is helping to enshrine. Turning towards social media, Biden called to hold platforms accountable by strengthening regulations. This shows a clear pattern. According to Biden, the solution to deepening crisis is to be found within the state itself and implemented through police orders. Such a position does nothing to address why these problems are arising to begin with. It presumes that all social ills can be combated through government programs rather than by fundamentally changing the power relations of our stratified society. With an eye towards the southern border, Biden also proposed the expansion of the surveillance state, claiming we're installing new technology like cutting-edge scanners to better detect drug smuggling. And while neo-fascists like Boebert and Marjorie Taylor Greene screamed build the wall as the rest of the crowd cheered during Biden's talk of immigration reform, Biden made clear his commitment to Clinton-era policies of border militarization while funneling in workers to keep the economy humming, stating, immigration reform is supported by everyone, from labor unions to religious leaders to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Biden went further, doubling down on immigration policies that months ago led to Border Patrol officers brutally whipping Haitian migrants and herding them into camps and then onto planes to be deported. He stated, we're putting in place dedicated immigration judges so families fleeing persecution and violence can have their cases heard faster. We're supporting partners in South and Central America to host more refugees and to secure their own borders. In short, Biden is stating his determination to continue supporting Trump-era border policies concocted by white nationalists like Stephen Miller, using COVID-19 as a pretext for denying asylum seekers the right to apply for visas and keeping Trump's system of militarizing borders south of the U.S. in place in an effort to clamp down on migrants and refugees. Out with Trump's overt xenophobic nativism, and back in with Biden's covert structural white supremacy enforced by neoliberal models. Biden ended his speech by talking about voting rights, healthcare, abortion access, and the onslaught of Republican-backed anti-LGBTQ bills that take aim at queer and trans youth in particular. Biden stated, "Protect access to healthcare. Preserve a woman's right to choose. As I said last year, especially to our younger transgender Americans, I will always have your back as president." These words have rung hollow as the Democrats have failed to deliver on securing or expanding these protections in the face of a cascade of Republican bills and draconian legislation. But perhaps the most important thing about Biden's speech was what he didn't say, only mentioning climate change twice in passing, once to call for tax credits to weatherize buildings, and again for economic competition with the rest of the world, particularly with China. He largely understated the crisis looming ahead of us. He did not acknowledge the climate emergency as a fundamental threat facing humanity and the continuation of life on this planet. He simply put a green window dressing on the same old economic nationalism that Trump has touted over the past 4 years. Ironically, on the same day as Biden's speech, the Associated Press, hardly a bastion of anti-capitalist sentiment, wrote on yet another released UN climate report, "Deadly with extreme weather now, climate change is about to get so much worse. It's likely going to make the world sicker, hungrier, poorer, gloomier, and way more dangerous in the next 18 years, with an unavoidable increase in risks," a new United Nations science report writes. "And after that, watch out." Hardly a friend to the environment, Biden has already signed more drilling permits on public land than Trump and also backed highly contested projects through native land such as Line 3, projects which have paid off local law enforcement for their role in suppression of grassroots resistance movements. Lastly, Biden made no mention of the January 6th attempted coup by Donald Trump and his supporters, both in the Republican Party and various far-right paramilitary groups. There was no discussion how the GOP is pushing to repeat the same game plan against a backdrop of attacks on voting rights and removing people from the rolls in mass numbers. There was no mention of the wave of far-right acts of murder and terror, which have only continued under Biden's presidency, from bomb threats against historically black universities, a white nationalist killing spree in Denver, the recent deadly far-right mass shooting in Portland, white supremacist plots to attack mosques and the power grid, waves of attacks and intimidation by groups like the Proud Boys across the U.S. and beyond. This is to say nothing about the continued embrace of white nationalists, QAnon, and anti-Semitic conspiracy theories by the Trumpian wing of the GOP, which were on full display last week as various elected Republican officials joined with neo-Nazi trolls at a white nationalist conference in Orlando, where the leader of the alt-right Groypers declared it was good that Putin was like Adolf Hitler. Like Trump, Biden is largely weak and vastly unpopular. pushed into office not because of his popularity, but because he simply wasn't the other person. Biden's proposed solutions to vast problems, as Politico wrote, was, quote, arguing for the passage of a grab bag of legislative proposals unfamiliar to most of the audience, and whose prospects range from slim to none at coming to fruition. But moreover, what Biden is selling is that neoliberal statecraft and policymaking, as opposed to class conflict and autonomous organizing, will address the vast inequalities, structural problems, and deepening crisis which has only grown under the last year of Biden's presidency. Biden's program and overall brand was always a return to normal. But not only is such a return not only possible, it also fails to address the growing threat of the fascist wing of the Republican Party, which is becoming increasingly insurgent and bloodthirsty. If the pandemic has taught us anything, it's that despite promises by politicians to address this or that crisis, we are on our own. As COVID-19 continues forward and we hurtle further into climate chaos and the possibility of global military conflict, the future of humanity will continue to depend on our ability to organize, act, and defend ourselves, the earth, and our communities, not in the half-baked promises of politicians who helped get us into this mess in the first place.
My name's Jaggy. I'm based in Montreal. And I'm with No Borders Media, and I've been active as an anti-authoritarian, anti-capitalist, anti-colonial organizer, activist in the Canadian state for about 20 years.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us. Well, let's just kind of pick off, I guess, where the last interview we did kind of like stopped, which is like right before the demonstrations last weekend happened. Just kind of give us your take, like, what all happened last weekend, and how does this change things?
Well, the weekend before, when the so-called Freedom Convoy, which is a far-right effort, and we can get into that later, but when that far-right convoy came into Ottawa, it's fair to say that everyone was taken by surprise by the fact that it ended up staying for so long with police collusion and complicity. Rig set up. And an occupation set up their GoFundMe, which eventually got shut down, but they're still funding otherwise, you know, was raising millions of dollars. You know, it's no shame to say this took people by surprise, even though we know a far right exists, even though we know that during the entirety of the pandemic, all over North America, all over Western Europe, all over Australia, New Zealand, there's been this weird convergence of conspiracy theorists, far right actors, and natural health people that have been demonstrating against the pandemic, sometimes with demonstrating against lockdown measures, and sometimes doing so with thousands and thousands of people. But still, this was a surprise, and they were entrenched. And it was like, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And in talking with comrades before some of these actions took place, there was this sort of debilitating argument being used by some folks that it wasn't safe to protest, or this lingering idea that somehow the cops and the state will take care of it, you know, all things that are pretty antithetical to an anarchist position, but also pretty antithetical to any sort of effective position. And so you had to confront that idea that, you know, it's not safe to go out. And one point I made to a comrade of mine, you know, when I heard about that argument was, you know what's not safe? Not doing anything. And I totally understand that there's different levels of risk for people, and we need to take into account that these far-right mobilizations will target people who are gay and trans and people of color and indigenous. But, we take into account what the risk is, and we try to meet it, taking into account that there's all kinds of roles that people can play behind the scenes and on the front lines. So that's sort of where people are at. What do we do? What do we do? In Montreal, we've been kind of lucky, I guess, insofar as the convoy wasn't planning to come through here. The Quebec solidarity action took place in Quebec City, which is perhaps a little bit more fertile ground for the far right than Montreal is. But we heard that the conspiracy theorist types and the Freedom Convoy supporters were going to do a protest and then head over to Ottawa at not one of their usual locations. Instead of in downtown Montreal, they're moving up to a park that's, you know, beside a mainly immigrant neighborhood. I think the main reason they chose that park was it's also close to the Trans-Canada Highway, so that their cars and trucks could head over to Ottawa. So we had to decide if we're going to do something. And, you know, to sort of go back a bit, for the last 18 months to 2 years, there have been these anti-lockdown, anti-mask, anti-vaccine, anti-government style protests happening in every major city. We know that. And, you know, if it was just the far right, I think we would have come out and tried to shut them down. But it wasn't just the far right. It was all kinds of people. So we were, you know, the mobilizations never took place. So we're trying to find our legs now. And here in Montreal, we decided, you know, let's try to do a counter demo. But we decided that about 24 hours in advance. And that decision was made by mainly, you know, community activists in the neighborhood around this park that I was talking about. Similarly, in Ottawa, they had all kinds of debates. One of their counter protests that was supposed to take place, it did happen, but technically a lot of groups distanced themselves from it because they thought it was too premature and all of that. So, you know, a week into this convoy, a week after that first weekend, it was decided, look, let's start getting our own selves mobilized. And that was the, that was sort of the factor here. And, you know, to give you a sense of this, it wasn't just anarchists and anti-fascists that were thinking this. It's also pretty mainstream liberal folks that were pretty pissed off that are now taking pretty seriously this far right threat. And, you know, often the discourse is not the discourse that I would put forward, like a NIMBY discourse of not in my backyard or the inconvenience of it. There's often a classist element to it. But there's a good dialogue to have with those folks. And, you know, the action we organized here in Montreal had that dialogue. And we said, look, let's concentrate on the message of exposing the far right, saying to people that are anti-vaccine mandates or anti-vaccine passports that, look, you can have that position, but don't show that position or have that position while you're complicit with far right actors. Let's not be ashamed to, or let's not hide the fact that we're working class as well. We're an anti-racist working class. You know, the front lines right now are women of color workers and other workers and all kinds of sectors of the economy that are invisibilized. Let's get out there and also denounce, you know, Justin Trudeau and the Premier of Quebec. There was a major far-right politician, a guy named by the name of Maxime Bernier, who was the featured speaker at this rally that they did in Montreal on our counter-protests of around 100 people. One of the chants we had that completely perplexed these folks that attended the other demo was, fuck Bernier, fuck Legault, fuck Justin Trudeau. In other words, you know, we were really making clear that we don't have any common cause with Justin Trudeau or François Legault, the Premier of Quebec, and definitely not with a far-right racist like Maxime Bernier. But the reasons why we oppose Trudeau and Legault are a lot different than, you know, those folks who are simply fixating on vaccines and lockdowns. So that's a little taste of where we were at. And, of course, that ended up being in solidarity with what was happening in Ottawa. One interesting thing about the Montreal action, you know, just to talk about the cops a bit, they mobilized the riot police like they always do in Montreal. And the riot police were mobilized basically to kettle us, 100 people, at a counter protest. So we weren't trying to like shut down their demo. We couldn't anyways. We were only 100 folks versus about 2,000 to 3,000. And of course, that 2,000 to 3,000 were not all far right racists. Far from it. They were just, you know, regular folks who, you know, are upset about the vaccine. Probably many of them have, you know, whatever, homophobic and racist attitudes. But, you know, it's a kind of crowd you'd handle differently than, you know, an obvious Proud Boy / Soldiers of Odin / Storm Alliance style demonstration. So, those cops kettle us. A lot of those riot cops that were the most active and tried to kettle us had the thin blue line patches on. Another way to expose the cops here, and, you know, a real exposition of, you know, what we know as the three-way fight, you know, that we're not only up here against the up against the fascists and the far right racists, but also up against the ruling class and the state. And that was something that was, you know, really useful to interact with, you know, more liberal minded comrades and friends. And the other thing really is something that I think is, you know, maybe could be more widespread is this idea of everyday anti-fascism, you know, like the idea that if you're not an anti-fascist, then what the fuck are you, right? Like anti-fascism can be a very unifying thing, especially when, again, more mainstream liberal progressive folks are recognizing that this is a threat. I mean, a lot of us have been talking about this for a while, definitely since 2015, 2016. But, you know, a lot of these other folks are recognizing this because of how enabled the far right has become in the last couple of years, particularly here up here in Canada.
Yeah, it's fascinating. We've been getting like a flood of comments from a lot of people that support the convoy on social media. And it's funny that it seems like the crux of their kind of pushback is that this is not a far right mobilization, or not everyone is far right, which is an interesting perspective. And then It's like, oh, so you support the government, then how can you be anti-authoritarian or anarchist? If you don't support this thing, then obviously you must support the state.
Yeah, and that's an argument worth addressing, you know, for what it's worth. So the so-called Freedom Convoy, the leadership and key organizers are part of the far right, and including the racist far right ecosystem here in Canada. There's just no doubt about that. I mean, you can name the players in this, and so that's the leadership, and that's also key organizers, key on the ground organizers. You know, people who have expressed white supremacist attitudes and Islamophobic comments, and these are only the things that we can discover. So that's a point, but it's also a point to say that not everybody there would identify with that. They're fed up with the lockdown. They have anti-vaccine views or vaccine critical views. They like being a part of a party atmosphere, you know, honking trucks and the rest of that. It's just part of the atmosphere. So, you know, you got to acknowledge that as well. But the point that I was making to the few folks that I was dialoguing with, because in Montreal this past Saturday when we did our counter-protest, you know, there was a part of the counter-protest before the riot cops showed up where we're just mingling with them, right? You know, these Canadian flag holders. And I would kind of make this argument with them. I'd be like, look, you know, the real problem here isn't unvaccinated people. I agree with you that we should stop fucking blaming unvaccinated people for the health crisis, like especially when the vaccine rates here in Canada are approaching upwards of 90%. The real issue isn't blaming other people. The real issue is the underfunding of the healthcare system by neoliberal capitalism. And a lot of these people would say, yeah, right on, I agree. And then the next point I make is, but why are you expressing that point of view with far right people? And the reaction I would get would be either denial, that's not true, and even if I give them the facts, they just wouldn't believe it, or it doesn't matter, right? And both positions are untenable, obviously, but that kind of dialogue still has to happen, right? Those people need to know that. I don't think we should write them off. You know, there's a way of doing it. And one way we were trying to do that in Montreal was by having that clear message and having flyers that put out that message that we are anti-Trudeau, we are anti-Legault, we don't support the government. We also don't want to give up that word freedom. And what we said here in Montreal was, you know, freedom goes along with social justice and solidarity, right? Like that freedom is part of that. It's not isolated from that. And obviously we can say other things, but, you know, when you're in a demo situation, you got to make it a quick, clear argument. So it is worth addressing that. And so a lot of people are just perplexed. And definitely, you know, Justin Trudeau and François Legault, the premier here in Quebec, and other political leaders haven't helped the situation because they're weaponizing the situation for their own political aims. Okay. And that's not a surprise. They're politicians, right? But, you know, Trudeau's been said, I mean, technically he said that some of the people who are anti-vaccine are racist and misogynist, right? So that is technically true. Of course, that's being portrayed by the far right and other people as Trudeau saying that everybody who's anti-vaccine or critical of vaccines, and obviously they're going to say not just critical of vaccines, but against vaccine mandates and against vaccine passports, which is a legitimate argument to have, that they're also racist and what have you. You know, here in Quebec, the premier of Quebec proposed, stunningly, he proposed that there was going to be a tax on people who were unvaccinated. Now, here in Canada, we have universal health care, right? The principle of that is when you go to a hospital, we don't judge you for like why you're in the hospital. You just get care, right? Doesn't matter that you didn't wear your helmet and you're in a bike crash or you've been a longtime smoker. You know, you don't get treated differently for that. And that was pretty fucked up. It was an attack on the universality of health care for what that's worth, right? And I mean, he took it back about 2 to 3 weeks later, because it was just so absurd to even propose that. But it was a demonization of unvaxxed people. So they've been riled up by fuck-ups, you know, the fuck-ups beyond the normal fuck-ups of political actors that are encouraging people to comply with healthcare measures and are using the attacks on unvaccinated people and blaming them to distract from, say, why they're not funding healthcare or why they're not providing free rapid tests or free N95 masks or why there aren't more income supports or why they're not providing, incorporating a rent freeze or any number of things that I can name, right? So that's a dynamic that's going on here, and it makes for a complex terrain. But within that complex terrain, you know, there is a clarity, which is these are fucking far-right people that are leading your movement and that are organizing that movement and that are funding that movement. And, you know, as we talked about earlier, you know, Fox News, a whole media ecosystem, a far right media ecosystem, political players in the U.S. They're all behind it for their own opportunistic reasons. So that needs to be acknowledged and exposed.
Any other interactions you had with folks last weekend, or things that they were saying?
You know, their protest had a lot of Canadian flags, either upside down Canadian flags or not, which for Montreal is weird because, you know, we're in Quebec. So the nationalism that's here is either Quebecois nationalism, or if there is Canadian nationalism, it doesn't express itself in that way because, you know, people will criticize it and what have you. So it's really weird to see that amount of Canadian flags. I was making a joke about that. Like, I was on the megaphone trolling the other side. And I'm like, so how do you sovereignists feel about all these Canadian flags? But within those Canadian flags, there's weird signage up, like, you know, the virus is not real and, you know, all kinds of conspiracy stuff and QAnon stuff. But, you know, the movement, insofar as you can say they have one, because there's all kinds of internal divisions and all kinds of, you know, competing interests. But insofar as they're trying to discipline themselves, they're trying to discipline themselves on the message of vaccine mandates and vaccine passports, because that is the one thing that can unify them, right? I mean, technically, this Freedom Convoy, which is not controlled by truckers, by the way. You know, some truckers that own their own trucks are involved, but it's definitely not representing all truckers. But anyways, you know, there are truckers who are unvaccinated and are pissed off that, you know, they can't do their long haul jobs in the U.S. And there's other people that are pissed off that if they don't get vaccinated, they're going to lose their jobs. And, you know, that as a common denominator is the most unifying thing that movement can have. So they're trying to discipline themselves around that message. But you poke around enough and you hear all this other crap, not the Islamophobic stuff, because that's not clearly here yet. You do hear some anti-Semitic stuff sometimes. Not hear it, but see it, where people are like saying, like, you know, the Jews are the ones who are poisoning you, you know, like vile shit. And that's, by the way, expressed by at least one of the key organizers of the Freedom Convoy. So, you know, that's what we're up against. I mean, and when I talk about the organizers of the Freedom Convoy, I'm concentrating on the Canadian ones, but there's a Quebec side of this as well. So when I was interacting with the people here in Montreal, like, one family, they were pretty nice, you know, they had some kids, they were pretty nice, and I managed to establish some trust with them because I made my whole spiel about how we should be blaming the government for underfunding healthcare, not blaming unvaccinated people. And they're like, yeah, right on. Who the hell are you? And then I was like, but, you know, there's races involved. They're like, no, they're not. And they're like, we're in Quebec. It's different. I'm like, well, you know, the main organizer of the Quebec City convoy and who speaks in all the media is a dude by the name of Bernard Rambo Gauthier. Rambo's his nickname. And this guy is a vile Islamophobe. It's like really well known in Quebec. And they're like, they're just in denial about it. So that's interaction. And I'm sure many of us, because we all will know somebody who was relatively progressive or what have you, that's sort of maybe not turned, but like has been attracted to some of these ideas. And we try to dialogue with them. And, you know, we go into the same loops, you know, even though we try to stay calm and all that. It's the same loop. There's denial or minimization, denial or minimization. And, you know, they're interacting with someone like me or you that's, you know, and other comrades of ours that are anti-state, that are not trusting of the mainstream media or of the government, that have built, you know, a track record on that over decades. So that's the nature of those interactions. The mind fuck, if I can say this, is the following. And a lot of people have observed this, okay? The mind fuck is the following. You know, it's one thing when you're up against the cops, okay? And it's another thing when you're up against the far right. Those of us that have been part of anti-fascist mobilizations, we can deal with that, right? I mean, there can be a lot of crazy shit that happens, violence and the rest of it, but we kind of expect that. The mind fuck is when you're facing up against people with their kids, right? And they're yelling at you. This didn't happen to me, but I'm describing what other people describe. And they're yelling at you. These far-right people or anti-vax people are yelling at you, and their kids are there, kind of perplexed or confused or what have you. That can't help but be a mind fuck to somebody, right? Because you don't want to go up against that. Or the other mind fuck is, you know, you're looking across the barricade to that other side, and there's people that you know as, you know, your friends. Maybe they're still your friends, you know, like people who are like alternative lifestyle types or whatever, you know, like ravers, hippies, whatever you want to call them. We all have those kind of friends that are on the other side. That's a mind fuck as well. So that's the reality that, you know, that's just something I want to highlight because that's something we need to steel ourselves for, right, and know how to deal with. But, you know, if this was just as simply dealing with fucking cops and far-right racists, it'd be a lot easier. But, you know, we got to deal with that level of complexity, acknowledge it, just don't dismiss everybody as, you know, as a fascist, or, you know, they've gone over the other side just because they showed up to one of these demos or what have you. And, you know, just be prepared for that level of fuckery that, you know, maybe we're not used to in the last little while.
Where are things at right now? Because we're hearing reports that there's like a state of emergency or like a suspension of civil liberties, essentially, that's been called by Trudeau. Are the police pushing back on people? Like, are they shutting down the blockades? And what does that mean for people in the streets on our side?
The city of Ottawa declared a state of emergency a while ago, and the province of Ontario, which is, you know, the province which Ottawa is in, also declared a state of emergency. But, you know, those states of emergency are meant to be able to access resources or make decisions quickly, right? They don't entail inherently a suspension of civil liberties. It's a kind of state of emergency that different governments did during the pandemic, so they can just say, you know, like, we're going to take over this community center and turn it into a vaccine site or a site for homeless people. But the Canadian government, the federal government, the Trudeau government, has brought in the Emergency Act. This is a revamp of the War Measures Act that's been used 3 times previously in Canadian history during World War I, World War II, and during the October crisis here in Quebec in 1970. But it's revamped because it's meant to be in stages, and it doesn't necessarily entail the involvement of the military. It has a level, I mean, I'm just talking now in very mainstream terms, but it has a level of court review. It's going to be going to Parliament, although the declaration's been made. So, you know, the kinds of powers that they're asserting are going to be that, for example, one big logistical fuck up in Ottawa and elsewhere as well, including Coutts, Alberta, where they had a border blockade that went on for about 2 weeks. It's now over, but the big logistical problem that the state was having was nobody would tow these trucks. That is, that, you know, there's a limited number of towing companies that have the capacity to tow big rigs. A lot of them know the truckers or what have you, and a lot of them are too afraid to do so for a variety of reasons, including, you know, like, they're going to get threats or they're friends with other people. They just didn't want to do it, so they weren't doing it. And the cops don't have enough of their own tow trucks, or if any. So one emergency thing that this act does is say we can commandeer these towing companies, like, they have to do it. And if not, they're going to be fined, that kind of stuff. And yes, it can mean, you know, suspension of civil liberties. They're declaring zones of Ottawa to be no-go zones. They're going to passed out flyers saying you're now in an illegal zone, and that can give the cops the right to go in and arrest people and what have you. But it is great. There's a gradation, right? So it's not quite like the War Measures Act. I just want to say that all factually, right? So that, you know, what the far right and what the supporters of the convoy are saying, and including the far right media and Fox News is saying, is, you know, there's a bit of a counter propaganda to that. But I and other anti-authoritarians and anarchists that I know, and many liberals that I know, are opposed to the imposition of this. This is fucked up. It's political theater by Trudeau, similar to the political theater that he was practicing earlier when he's telling people that, you know, if you're not vaccinated, that's the problem. It's the unvaccinated that are the problem, etc. Because, you know, the state has the powers it needs to deal with what they want to deal with, right? It's just that because of the demographic profile of the people they're dealing with, a lot of cops aren't responding or are sympathetic to it or openly colluding with it. But to give an example, in Windsor, on the Detroit-Windsor border, that bridge is a key infrastructure, right? Like, upwards of 40% of all trade between Canada and the U.S. Goes through that bridge. You know, the cops are able to clear it eventually. So the cops have the power they need. It's just that this is political theater. And in terms of how I feel about it, is that all this repressive power that the state is using now is going to be used worse on Indigenous communities, on people of color organizing, on left organizing, on anti-capitalist organizing in the future. It gives the far right a victory. It gives, like, sort of a propaganda victory. It gives them a martyrdom complex, and it's not necessary, but it's part of the political theater of what's going on. And what it does is it clouds the fact that we should continue to develop our own community self-defense. You know, I go back to that three-way fight that I'm sure you've talked about many, many times on your show in a variety of contexts. We keep ourselves safe. We need to build that capacity. There's an enormous awareness now by, you know, non-radicals, but, you know, people who are sympathetic to our point of view that, yeah, it's we keep ourselves safe. We need to get out there and do blockades We need to get out there and do shit. Like, obviously, we can't remove rigs, but, you know, we need to develop that capacity because the state will do what the state does. So it's highly problematic that that was brought in, but it isn't as if there's soldiers on the streets of Ottawa right now and all of that. And I think one aspect of this that's worth exploring a bit is the following. It's not for me to speculate about what the state might do or not, because I don't know. I don't have any inside knowledge. But, you know, through mainstream media reports, it's pretty clear that one thing they're going to focus on is funding. And one thing that these powers give them is to be able to tell banks to freeze the funding of people that are funding illegal activity. So they're going to claim that if you're sending money to any of the Freedom Convoy things, that's funding an illegal activity, and they're going to freeze that funding. And, you know, just like back in the day, you know, if you want to shut down the mafia, maybe you can try to arrest them all, or you can try to just deal with wherever they launder their money. You know, like Al Capone eventually was put in jail for tax evasion, right? Not for, like, actually killing people. So similarly, maybe that, you know, they might have a shrewd thing here, which is that if we can just cut off their funding, there could be attrition here, because clearly this money helps them keep this going. It takes thousands of dollars to keep these rigs running, like, obviously not running, like, doing their loads across the country, because they're not doing that. But even the diesel fuel that's needed, these are families often. These are people that are getting money. Like, I've seen, you know, videos of, like, people handing thousands of dollars over, like far right people who are collecting money, handing it over to truckers saying, please stay, here's the money to do so. So if you know, that's cut off to a significant extent, that, you know, that might play a role, and that might be something that's in the reasoning of why they're bringing this in. But again, to be really clear, this is not something to be supported by progressives and the left and anarchists. And not only that, but it should be opposed, just like, you know, we should have opposed, we have opposed other fucked up measures that the state has taken during this pandemic.
Investigations that have come out, people have scraped basically the information that's been found in a lot of these websites where people have been donating money to. And it's, you were saying that, like, two-thirds of the folks that have been donating have been, like, outside of Canada, largely U.S., a lot of, like, big donors, a lot of wealthy individuals. Do you just kind of want to say, like, what that means and what that makeup kind of points to?
Before doing that, it's worth acknowledging that, you know, the fact that that list was hacked and revealed publicly is an example of our community self-defense. You know what I mean? So it's not just, you know, on the streets. It's that kind of stuff as well. So we keep ourselves safe, and by getting that kind of information, we can expose who's funding. And insofar as some of those folks care about the, you know, optics, you know, these are some business owners and what have you, that's useful. A majority of the people actually sending in money are from the U.S. Although, you know, to be honest, I don't care, right? Like, if we had a major progressive left-wing mobilization, a ton of people were sending us money from all over the world, I don't give a fuck about, you know, that would be great, right? So I don't think we should get too caught up on that. Although it is telling that a lot of that money, like, for example, a U.S. tech billionaire gave about $90,000. The highest donation was $200,000, but it's unclear who made that donation yet, unless that information has been updated, because it was still being processed. But, you know, there are property developers, there are landlords, there are corporate owners that have contributed. You know, we know there's a far right out there, and there's the public far right manifested through certain politicians or certain political movements, but there's the money behind it. There's always been money behind creeping fascism. And so it's great to expose it. But at the same time, there are a lot of small donations too, you know? And just to let people know, like, GoFundMe shut down that fundraiser under pressure. But this is the funding list through GiveSendGo, which is a far right Christian funding site. You know, they allow the Proud Boys in the U.S. and other people that get shut down on the more mainstream funding sites to operate. But it's great that that was revealed, and it does really expose who's behind it. But I don't have any juicy, you know, funders yet. You know, just some of your low key billionaire douchebags. And millionaire douchebags.
You know, one of the things that was written about in the recent Crime Think piece, I'm sure you saw that I thought was really on point, was it was saying, like, within the people that are mobilizing and protesting against the far-right blockade, we've got to kind of think about, too, this sort of, like, they defined it as sort of a NIMBYism, like not in my backyard push that a lot of people have of like, you know, we've got to call in the military or we've got to get the state to like recognize this. But there also seems to be a big turn in people kind of realizing that the government is basically allowing this to happen and the police are sort of working or at least acquiescing to the demonstration. So there's a consciousness rising. There's a push to do things on people's own terms. Like, you know, we keep us safe, that whole sort of ethic. I'm just curious if you can kind of speak to that tension.
Yeah, I mean, it's a useful tension because it means that there's some level of co-organizing and dialogue between a wide swath of progressive people because we need numbers. You know, we need to be out there. And, you know, a part of that is just, you know, their reflex is like, you know, not in Ottawa. It's an inconvenience. The diesel fumes, the noise. You know, and my position on that is just that, you know, if you live in downtown Ottawa, there's going to be noisy protests. I mean, it's like, you know, the whole gentrifiers in cities that are pissed off because there might be noise at night, you know, in downtown areas. So, but, you know, there's a dialogue around that. And, you know, people are moving to the stronger arguments, which is that, you know, there's harassment of folks that is happening because of this, you know, especially young service industry people, you know, who are masked on the job, you know, at their Starbucks or Tim Hortons or whatever, you know, and because they're masked, they get made fun of. And there's often a lot of sexist, homophobic and racist harassment that's aimed at those folks. So that's something to talk about. And of course, just the broader threat of the far right is something to do. But I think that tension is useful. And obviously not everybody has the patience for that dialogue, but we need people who have the patience to have that dialogue. You know what I mean? Convergences and coalitions are how, you know, our movements are stronger. You know, the strength of Defund the Police as a movement potentially is that, you know, you got reformists who aren't for abolition of the police, but they're like, you know, they're funded too much. We got to take money away from them. And you got radicals like us who are abolitionists and like, we got to abolish the police. But, you know, in the meantime, I don't mind taking away millions of dollars from their fucking budgets and putting it to useful stuff. And that's a convergence, right? So we need that similar kind of thing. I do think this Emergency Act and the fact that, you know, a lot of those liberals will be like, okay, now the state might act. Maybe an outside police force will come in or because the police chief of Ottawa resigned, maybe they'll get serious about it. But there's a lot of people that learned a fucking difficult lesson, which was, yeah, the cops are not on your side and they're in collusion. You know, there's a lot of ex-cops and ex-military that are part of the key organizers of this far-right convoy. I mean, personally, I'm just pissed off because you got like people who used to work for INSET. INSET is the Integrated National Security Team. It's anti-terrorism team here in Canada that was put together and it was used during the G8 and G20 in Toronto, right? So you got these fuckers that were part of that ended up kettling and arresting and having tear gas and all kinds of crap aimed at, you know, thousands and thousands of people who were resisting the G8 and G20 in Toronto. And now here they are 10 to 12 years later, you know, claiming that the state is oppressing them when they were the state actors, you know, who were complicit in all the shit that's happened before, including a lot of anti-Muslim stuff that's happened that the state has done. But, you know, to go back to the heart of your question, you know, that dialogue is a good tension to have. And you can see a progression in people's arguments instead of just, you know, the simple NIMBYism or saying, you know, the cops are going to help us out and all of that. Or this sort of stereotypical polite Canadianism, which is that, you know, if the government says you're going to do something, you should do it. So these people are all wrong. Right. And obviously that's bullshit. You know, that dialogue is starting to happen now and it's happening outside of social media, which is good. I also want to mention, you know, like on a more positive note, there's a lot of, you know, beyond the, you know, in addition to like the counter protest in Ottawa this past Saturday, and we had a modest one here in Montreal for the small protest they had here. And there was there've been some cool counter protests in Winnipeg. In Vancouver, the week before, bikers, like cyclists, were able to block trucks from getting into the city. That was really inspiring. So in addition to that, and in addition to the, you know, the hacker or hackers that revealed the donation list, there's been some other, you know, fun creative stuff. I don't know if you've heard of the Ram Ranch Resistance.
Yeah, well, I've heard about it. There's been a couple articles, but
yeah,
walk us
through.
So,
you know,
that.
Ram Ranch is a song. It's sort of a gay porn song about cowboys and sex. and a lot of other stuff. And this is just being used to troll the hell out of these folks, right? And it's hilarious. It's funny. It's witty.
There was a Twitter thread that came out recently of like a journalist sitting in a chat with a bunch of the organizers. And basically, there were so many people that were like either posing as far-right protesters and then trolling them, or just like people that had no idea what Ram Ranch was. Anyway, it was just hilarious. Yeah, it's funny.
Exactly. And that's inspiring, you know. And, to go back to the Ottawa one, because I think when you interviewed the comrades from Punch Up Collective, that was just before their protest happened. Well, you know, they succeeded in blocking an attempt by some of the trucks to get closer to downtown. They succeeded in doing that for 8 hours and forced the trucks to turn back. Actually, it wasn't just trucks. There were actually very few trucks. It was actually like vans and, you know, just people trying to go to support the convoy, far right people that are trying to go to support it. They forced some people to get rid of their decals, including racist decals, you know. They started out as just a few hundred, you know, organized behind the scenes, and they ended up being thousands, right? That's exciting. And I mention all of this because the other element here that's important to keep in mind, and you'll appreciate this because this is what you do, is counter-propaganda, right? And the far-right ecosystem is on that, you know? I mean, they're doing a lot of fucking lies, of course, making shit up, like people who are claiming that there were millions in Ottawa for this protest, or making up other stuff, or if they see somebody who's like a person of color at their demo, like that becomes a whole thing, you know? But we need to get better at our counter-propaganda. And, you know, it's not an admonition to anybody, just that, you know, that's part of the struggle as well. Like sussing out our stories, our success stories, our ability to mobilize, because it's inspiring. And that has, you know, that has its own momentum, right? And so I'm mentioning these things, but, we need to get it out there. And we don't have our equivalent of Fox News and all that, and we don't want to. But, the other equivalents that we can have, we need to really take advantage of that and get the message out.
For sure. I want to ask you where you think things are going in the next couple of days, because, soon the next weekend's going to come up, and it seems like there'll be more people in town. But I wanted to ask you first, what do you think the wider repercussions for the Canadian state will be because of this, both in terms of a possible shift to the right and also just the Conservative Party seemingly kind of opening itself up to these people, but also in terms of, I guess, on the left, more folks losing faith in the state and getting this taste of self-organization?
In terms of that taste of self-organization, that needs to be sustained. And it might not, right? So a lot of those folks will go back to their habits, which is not surprising, right? There's a lot of ways to look at this, right? One overarching thing that's clear, and this is clear not only in Canada, but in the US and all over Western Europe and all over the world, is there's been a normalization of the far right, including the fascist far right. And the far right are also activists, right? You know, one thing that's kind of just so fucked up is that, you know, Fox News is cheerleading illegal activity, right? When BLM and other groups are, you know, engaging in stuff that's not even comparable to, like, you know, shutting down a main economic artery for like a week or two, which is what happened at the Ambassador Bridge, or shutting down an entire border crossing and keeping trucks, you know, from crossing for 2 weeks, which is what happened in Alberta. You know, like literally the far right ecosystem is cheerleading this. So there's a normalization of not just the far right, but of them being activists and them using direct action tactics. So that's an overarching thing. When I mentioned before that, you know, the Liberal Trudeau government is also, you know, opportunistically weaponizing or, you know, doing political theater, it's for their own aims, because there's a feeling, and polling bears this out, that all of this stuff is helping Trudeau. There's a feeling that, you know, maybe he's in a minority government, so maybe he'll call an election, although I doubt he will, because he kind of got burned when he did it last time and he came back with a minority government. But in terms of the electoral calculations, that might be more helpful to them. And, you know, a divided right wing, electoral right wing, because the leader of the far right, openly far right party here, the People's Party of Canada, the PPC, which is the political center, by the way, of what these far right convoys are, right? the leader is Maxime Bernier. He was the guy who was speaking in Montreal before they headed off to Ottawa. He broke away from the Conservative Party because, well, he almost won their leadership, and he got, you know, it's the typical politics. He just wanted to have his own party. So he broke away. So, you know, to have two far-right parties or almost far-right parties, like, that's an electoral disaster for the Conservatives. So, you know, we'll see what happens. But, you know, we don't make those kind of electoral calculations because the actual calculation is the one I already talked about, an incredible normalization of the far-right as political actors on the street. For the last 2 years, they've been part of these conspiracy theory, anti-lockdown, anti-vaccine protests. But because they're part of them, they're sort of hidden in them and have sort of normalized themselves there. And they haven't faced, you know, an anti-fascist response for a variety of reasons that, you know, I think made sense at the time, which is that, you know, let the fucking conspiracy theorists have their fucking demos. You know, they'll peter out or whatever. But no, they have a certain power now. And you know, for me, the you know, instead of getting too caught up in the electoral calculations and all of that, it's that, you know, we need to build that community self-defense. We need to reinforce our networks of mutual aid and solidarity and care. We need to internationalize. We need to, you know, have pan-Canadian solidarity and meet that threat. So that's sort of how I'm looking at it. And, you know, regardless of how this plays out, it has been a wake-up call just because, you know, we've just never seen these kinds of actions by the far right. And it's exposed white supremacy, it's exposed police collusion and the rest of it, and those become, you know, building blocks for us to have a true anti-authoritarian community style response to this stuff in all our communities. And, you know, those kinds of conversations are happening all over the place right now.
Well, what's going to happen in the next couple of days, do you think, or coming up?
Well, you know, there's Ottawa, and then there's the stuff happening elsewhere. Now, it's important to acknowledge that the diehards of the Ottawa occupation and other actions, they're pretty committed, you know, like a lot of them are openly talking about, like, this is where I make my stand, I'm going to die. And let's keep in mind, like, just, you know, as a prelude to this, beyond, like, you know, the 2 years of the pandemic and these folks mobilizing, you know, like, you know, I'm no fan of Trudeau, but, like, you know, he's a recipient of serious threats, you know, of serious political violence. There was an ex-military person who rammed a vehicle into his residence or tried to enter his residence, you know, during the election. There were people throwing, you know, stones and rocks at him, which is sort of unheard of. So that kind of mobilized political violence by the far right is really problematic. And these are the kind of folks that, you know, when push comes to shove, are going to hold their ground. We don't have quite the same level of gun culture that you know, that you have in the U.S., but by the same token, there is, you know, there's legal gun possession here and what have you. I don't think it'll play out in that way, but you know, for me the worst case scenario is, you know, you have cops moving in, you know, riot cops with, you know, using the techniques that they use on us, but using it on them with their bouncy castles and their kids, you know, like it's gonna look really fucking bad. And that's why I think they'll be pursuing. I mean, again, it's not for me to give fucking advice to them, but, like, one way it plays out is just slow attrition. Because the people who are pissed off about it, you know, the liberal residents of Ottawa and, you know, their supporters elsewhere, we're not going to riot about it, right? It's like we're going to build our self-defense and deal with this crap, and hopefully the attrition will play out. The Coots, Alberta, I don't know if you've talked about that with anybody else, but the Coots, Alberta blockade, you know, on the Alberta-Montana border was really fucking serious, because for 2 weeks they shut down that border. It's not as significant a border as the Ambassador Bridge, but there was total police collusion. Now, that only ended because the police made some arrests of an alleged conspiracy of people who were going to defend it, linked. If you look at some of the imagery they had on the guns and other paraphernalia that the police showed, linked to this thing called the Plaid Army / Diagonal. Diagonal is this weird far-right idea of creating a whites-only, you know, diagonal state, like, you know, that takes in Idaho and Montana and parts of Alberta, you know, just sort of this diagonal that goes through what they consider to be the white areas, and then the coastal areas are, like, for the multiculturalists. I kind of hated that I know this, but, you know, I know it so other people don't have to bother to go into it. But in any case, these far-right, like, accelerationists imagery was part of what they found. And because that was found, the other people who are also far right and are pretty committed were like, we don't want to associate with that. We're going to end our blockade. So that's how that ended, right? Because the cops did that. And we'll see to what extent they actually have a case against these 11 people. Because, you know, the cops also make up cases against the far right. So we'll see. But that's how that ended. Now, you know, they have the power to shut down other border crossings, to decentralize. Around Ottawa, and this is something maybe you haven't heard of yet, but around Ottawa, there's staging grounds, you know, where they have trucks parked.
3FM is proud to rebroadcast the following program entirely in the Mohawk language. The Mohawk, or Gagnak Gehaga, are the original people of the unceded traditional territory known as Montreal, or Jojaake. The Gagnak Gehaga, or people of the Flint, have two communities close by, and they are working hard at revitalizing their language. This program is part of those efforts, and it originally aired in Ganasadage on RKR, reviving Ganasadage Radio. And now, listen to Jojaake's indigenous language on CKUT.
Kwewe gana sa da gehrono, dana gahna wa gehrono. Dana na akte no za wa dahusa de da ga akwe za srono doga ni gahte gehrono. Doga ni ni o ni ne wahta doga ni o swega. Doga ni akte no ni za wa dahusa de gwa hagwego wat kuna hwara adona ge are za ya gana wa I ne ta haswa te ni waksa no ta.
Ta anu kong I ge swahni di yo.
Nega di ne ne oja ge, ne ne a a doga gahna wa ge onska. Dewa niawr dano asa FM zawa da hunsa da dana na gana sadaage onska dewa niawr dano onska yu jistokwere zaada FM Gwaha gwegu wat kuna huaraadu Izi o ni wahni diya wat kuna huaraadu ayawaski a gwegu skanu agahaga Nizari wat suunga dano na zahwaajire a gwegu skanu agahaga Yu wezagi tuza jadatka wata waka diri waharaho za zahyaak sara jina hayaki diyo duwa yuki ni wana rastam Next year, where's it? Why I actually had the energy? I still have.